Hello, everyone. My name is Eric Hanischek. I'm the Paul and Jean Hanna Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and I want to welcome you to the Hoover Capital Conversations. For those of you who aren't very familiar with the Hoover Institution, let me give you just a brief overview. We have, for more than a century, emphasized scholarship and generating ideas from our fellowship and our library and archives. We have the idea that providing scholarship can help develop our free society and improve our conditions. Capital Conversations is an ongoing series that features discussions between those of us who try to generate ideas about improvement and those of us who can be in a position to develop and implement those ideas in reality. Today, we have the distinct pleasure of having a conversation with Assistant Secretary Jim Blue of the Federal Department of Education. Just to give you heads up, there will be a question and answer period at the end. And if you have questions to submit, hit the Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. Jim Blue serves as the Assistant Secretary for Planning, Evaluation, and Policy Development of the U.S. Department of Education. He's a long-standing advocate for educational reform, and his prior roles include serving as Director of 50CAN Affiliate Student Success California, National President of Students First, National Director of the Alliance for School Choice, and its predecessor, the American Education Reform Council. Additionally, he spent over a decade guiding the Walton Family Foundation's K-12 reform investments. So let's dig right in. As a way of finding out what an assistant secretary does, Jim, could I ask you to introduce the topics that are currently on your desk? We want to have the people get some idea of your regular activities.
Well, thanks, Rick, for having me today. So as you can imagine, there is a lot on the desk of somebody who's doing the policy shop work for the secretary. We can probably bucket into a few things. We are constantly in 3 years at once. One is the current fiscal year, which just started. We are operating under a continuing resolution. And so we have a lot of work right now about how are we going to implement all of our programs during the coming year. We can look at the CARES Act, which was passed at the end of March. For those of you who are not familiar with it, it was a $2.2 trillion stimulus package that the president signed, I think, on March 27th or 28th. And we had to get $30 billion out to both institutions of higher education and all of the 100,000 local education agencies around the country. A lot of policy informed that work. And then the last piece of our puzzle right now is more future oriented. We're already preparing the budget for fiscal year 22, which doesn't begin for a full year. And we are looking toward a stimulus package. Most of your listeners will know that the president just continued negotiations on a comprehensive package, but that opens the opportunity for a lot of standalone packages. People are talking about the airlines, for example, needing aid. And as part of those discussions, they're still talking about stimulus for the education, both higher ed and K-12. In addition to that, all of the grant making that's done by the department has policy implications. That comes through us. We have a shop that focuses very specifically on student privacy and another shop on ed tech. So that's what's sort of piled on my desk today.
I'm happy that we can see over the pile that you just sketched out here, see you.
Yeah.
Let's start with a few big issues. Particularly when we think about K to 12 education, the federal government is not the central actor in this, representing only about 10% of the total funding. And the most recent federal act for elementary and secondary education, the Every Student Succeeds Act, put a lot more emphasis on the states and pushed the federal government back. What can the federal government do best in this world, and what is done best locally?
Yes. So this is sort of the core issue for the secretary. The amount that was spent last year for K-12 from the federal government was only 7%. It was less than 10%. That, of course, has changed during the stimulus time. And the largest program actually wasn't a program that's part of the education department. It was the school lunch program, nutrition program, which is managed by a separate department. So the Department of Education has a very small financial footprint. Over the 40 years of its existence, though, its role became more and more muscular. And there was eventually pushback, blowback, you might call it, where the local and state governments said, you know, we are the people closest to the problems, and we're the ones that should get to make those decisions. I don't know what would have happened under another secretary, but Betsy DeVos agrees completely with that. She's a big fan of subsidiarity, meaning that the institution closest to the problem should solve, be empowered to solve that problem. She of course means state and local government, districts. She also means the family as an institution that should be given more power to take control of the education of their children. So we're wholeheartedly, and there's problem, you know, doesn't get talked about as much, but I think there are 1,200 pages of regulations that we have put in the graveyard. We've had a whole different philosophy of empowering states and local districts to do the work.
Well, you brought up the topic of the interest of the secretary and how she's been guiding the department. We all know that one of her big interests is in supporting choice of parents of their schools. Does the federal government have a role there, or is she just standing on the bully pulpit, or how could that best be enhanced?
Yeah. So first of all, there is undoubtedly a bully pulpit role, and that is something that our polling tells us we've been very successful at. More and more parents and voters, citizens, are coming to the conclusion that it just doesn't make sense the way we have a factory model public education system where nobody's given much choice about what they do with their own children. We're seeing in, for example, African-American communities, the polling above 70% support for the right to choose the school that you think is best for your child. So there is a role there, and it's been, you know, it's been a constant theme of hers. I always want to talk about something. You know, we're not making up school choice for this. There's a reason we think school choice is needed, and it is that our education system isn't doing a very good job. And there are very few levers to fix that. One, of course, and it comes from particularly from groups that have public employees that are part of the education system, where the answer is always more money. Right? That is going to be the solution. So our point of view is very different. that if we could get our education system to work like pretty much every other sector of our economy works, where consumers can choose, where providers can meet the needs of those consumers, we'd have a much more effective system, and one that is self-correcting. And one that probably would be more nimble than what we've seen in the last several months. So all that to say, like, we're not just doing it because we believe in school choice, we're believing because school choice will improve student outcomes. Now, what can the federal government do? Particularly after I went on my tirade about how we are not gonna be involved or telling people what to do around the country. Her signature proposal is federal tax credit, which isn't a program per se. It's simply saying we're going to incentivize donations to scholarship granting organizations. And those organizations would be identified by the state, and the state would define the whole program. Our position is parents need more choices. Families need more choices. And we don't actually care how you give them more options, but the only thing we're asking is that you take that scholarship and you give it to a family and you let them decide among a variety of options. So it is not exactly a federal program. It's more like we're incentivizing 50 state or 52 state programs around the country. It's called Education Freedom Scholarship, if anybody wants to go look it up on our website.
I'm not sure exactly what an assistant secretary can say on a public discussion, but the whole idea behind the ESSA law was that the state should take a more central role and should be the prime drivers of education.
Right.
Is it working? Can you say anything about how well that's working?
I think we've made a lot of progress. It's a fascinating thing. A culture developed over 40 years where when people were told they had to do something, the first thing they did was ask the federal government what was the right thing to do. And that knee-jerk reaction still goes on today. We certainly saw it during CARES Act, because suddenly this big glob of money is coming to people. They wanted to make sure that what we were saying really meant they had the freedom to spend this money the way they wanted. That was like the ultimate block grant. They got the money. There are a few constraints in the law. We clarified those. And it actually is working pretty well. And our experience is governors, state chiefs, local superintendents, they're really liking it. Before this, they constantly just complained about how the federal government was getting in their way. Then for a while, they were complaining like the federal government isn't clearing about what it wanted. And now I think they're getting used to being actually in an environment where they can make decisions.
Well, one of the things that's going on today, which relates to that, is how do we know whether things are getting better or not? There's been a lot of recent discussion about too much testing and pushback on accountability. And in fact, that's been pushed to the point where a number of states, I believe, are at your door, probably right this moment, asking for waivers from the requirements to test students and to publish the results. Where do you think this is going to go?
Well, you know, the law is clear, and the secretary is very clear about following the law. States are required to do that, those state achievement tests, those assessments, third through eighth grade, math and English. You know, it is possible that situation will preclude states from doing this. And they certainly did last March. And we just said, we understand, we're giving everyone a waiver. You don't need to give the test. But people started asking literally within days of the school season beginning, like, we don't want to do tests anymore. And our response to that has been, you should not expect a waiver this time. The law is clear. It's good for students. It's good for instructors who need to understand where their students are. And so we're standing by that. I don't want to say we would never give a waiver. That's always possible. But, you know, we're talking about several months from now when students would be taking the test. And we're actually encouraging people to evaluate where their students are now, because we know there's been a lot of learning loss over the last several months.
Let me pick up on that last idea, and maybe we could talk a little bit more about what you see as happening in this very strange year. The schools have been back for a month and so forth. Credo here at Hoover just recently published some estimates that showed huge learning losses from the school closures last March going into today. And in particular, they indicate very large discrepancies between the learning of kids in disadvantaged families versus more advantaged families, where in some families, the parents can really chip in and take the place of the teacher, and in others, they're not as prepared. What do you know about what's happening over the beginning of this year, and where do you think it's going to go? Do you have some thoughts on?
I have deep fears about it, if you don't mind me expressing those for just a minute here. I don't think it has sunk in to the public just how serious this is. There's a lot of concerns about other issues right now in education than what's happening to our students. And it's been devastating, particularly to disadvantaged students, as you've said, to special needs children. And we need a major effort to reverse or close the gap that's been created over the last several months. I don't want to be too alarmist, but I hope we will also, there's individual impact on each of these students. And everything we know tells us we don't know how to fix that, that we literally don't have the tools to figure out how to remediate a student, at least at scale. We have lots of some examples of, but so we're literally facing this huge deficit, no clue about how to fix it. And I hope we'll also get into the research you recently did. Like, this doesn't only affect individual students, the impact on society and on our economic productivity is mind-boggling, and nobody is coming to terms with it. It's perhaps that we're in the middle of an election cycle or whatever, but at some point we have to deal with how devastating this is for our students and our society.
Well, I mean, I can only support your alarmist views. In my opinion, there aren't enough people that are alarmed about the implications of the learning losses that they've already suffered and are likely to suffer. I mean, just to bring the audience and everybody up to my estimates, which are, I think, a lower bound, the least harm that you could expect from the losses suggests that the average student who suffered the school closures would face 3% less lifetime earnings. And this is a permanent loss unless we do something about it. And for the US, it means that we have a less competent, less productive workforce in the future, and that affects economic growth. My estimates, again, are in today's dollars, are something like $14 trillion lost as a minimum from these closures. And to me, I'm not sure that you were alarmist enough, Jim, that somehow we have to mount an effort to try to remediate that. Just getting back to where we were in 2019, I don't think is going to solve the problem.
Yes. And I should just connect some dots here. The your estimates were based on, I think, a third of a year loss, and the estimates that Dr. Raymond and Credo made were at least a couple times that, right? It's hard to understand because of the distributions, but she's saying there's even deeper learning losses. I don't know if we would double or triple the numbers you were, your present values there.
Well, pretty much you would double them at least. And to me, that suggests that we have to be doing something. But as you said before, you know, everybody says, well, if we got to do something, let's just spend more money.
Yeah, we're encouraging a more nimble system where you can actually reach, meet every child where they are. And we now know, you know, there was never an average child in education, but now the variance because of the learning loss, I mean, there are a lot of families that were able to continue learning and teaching their students, their children. So there's even a greater divide. And so we have to figure out a way to both continue to develop students at one end and the other. And our system is not built to do that. And so it's a real challenge for us.
We're going to go soon to question and answers. I remind everybody, this is the Capital Conversations from the Hoover Institution. I'm Eric Hanischak, and we have Assistant Secretary James Blue on with us to talk about education issues. We're going to go to your questions and answer period. There's a Q&A button at the bottom of your screen. If you have any questions, please just click that and type in your questions. And while people are ready to grill you, Jim.
Yes.
We haven't said anything about higher education. That's another part of your bailiwick, and that and in some ways the department may be thought of as stronger in the higher education area than in K to 12. Do you want to say anything about what's going on in higher education today?
Sure. The first point is an important one. The federal government actually plays a much larger role. It's not 7%. It's closer to 40% of revenue for higher ed comes through the federal department in two forms. One is, of course, the Pell Grants, the scholarships for economically disadvantaged students. And then through our loan portfolio. It used to be when I talked about our loan portfolio, people would be surprised at its magnitude. It used to be in this town that a trillion and a half was a lot of money. $1,500 billion, right? And you know what we have seen is that seems smaller, like you were just talking about $14 trillion, as if the human mind can get around that number, right? So it is a very large part of what the department does. It's half of our employees work solely on that. So it is a big function. What's happening, I'll just sort of make an observation. There's one debate about that loan portfolio. There's a lot of debt out there. And there's one school of thought that students were given loans by the federal taxpayer. They could go get a better education, be more economically productive. That's the deal. And then they'd be able to pay back their loans. There is another school of thought that, you know, things didn't work out for a lot of those students who took out their loans, and that there needs to be sort of a blanket forgiveness for all of that. And that's a debate that will be solved. In the meantime, what we're focused on is doing it well. You know, when we came in, if anybody on this call has student loans, they may have multiple loans, and it was very difficult to get service and questions answered. And so we've spent a lot of time just making the service better. There's now one website, one phone number, all things that banks did 20 years ago. We finally got around to doing. And we've done a good job. I think we've really improved services. When COVID happened, we then had to shut down all those systems in a way that would not, so people were not paying on their loans anymore. And now we're looking at when all of this is over, ramping back up the machinery. And so we're a lot of focus on these issues right now. And then we also have just one of the most complicated student loan policies. And there's 9 different repayment plans. And, you know, so it's a little crazy. And so we're trying to come up with a way to work with Congress to come up with a unified, coherent, sensible approach to using taxpayer funds to improve the economy by giving loans to people. So.
Thanks. Maybe we'll just open it up to a couple of questions that we have.
Sure.
One of the first is asking for more explanation about the Freedom Scholarships, Education Freedom Scholarships. And in particular, it's phrased a little bit strongly. It's how does this program uphold Secretary DeVos's principle of state and local control over education? Why should the federal government be driving choice?
Yeah, we're not. It's a completely voluntary program. You know, we incentivize donations to these scholarship granting organizations. There are a couple of rules around that. You have to be a 501c3, which triggers some tax accounting and reporting for accountability purposes. But beyond that, everything is designed by the state. And I know this is really hard. Our system has been compulsory for so long that you're told everything you have to do. This program is voluntary in terms of who even contributes, whether a school participates, whether a family accepts a scholarship, whether a state participates at all. All those are voluntary, and I realize it's hard for people to get their heads around it, but this is not Secretary DeVos or the federal government telling people what they have to do. It's giving them an opportunity to do something.
Thank you. Another question on sort of ESSA and NCLD. It's the role of federal government might take in improving the data and transparency. In particular, there are requirements to publish data on achievement and achievement by subgroups and so forth. But there's not very much information about such things as waiting lists for charter schools or other data on families' choices in education that don't come from just the normal census accounting data. Can you speak? Is there any hope to improve the broader transparency about our schools?
Well, I have a lot of hope about that. I'm a big advocate of data and transparency. There's a real question about whether that should be done at the federal level or the state and local level. And I think the way to ensure that state and local governments come through on this is to keep asking them to see what's going on. A little interesting sidebar on this, the ESSA did require states to publish how much money they're spending at the school level and where that money is coming from, whether it's state, federal, or local. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because the law is sort of immersed in subsidiarity, everybody got to design for themselves how they were going to be reporting this data. It was clear what they had to report, but not how. And so this is an area where we've stepped in. We've created a new website so people can go up and analyze the data, their expenditure, per pupil expenditure data at a website. And I think we may see more of that in other areas where it's too hard for people to do an accurate comparison. Charter Shorter waiting list may be one of those, but for now, we're really focused on where the money is flowing. I said earlier that one solution is always give me more money. Another solution may be to say, how are we spending that money and how could we spend it better? And that's the kind of insights you can get if you learn how to deal with this data.
So another caller wants to throw a slow pitch down the center of the plate to you and sort of ask, observes that our colleges with their competition among colleges seem to be doing a very good job, and that's different than K-12. So what will it take to get some more healthy competition into the K-12 system in the US?
Yeah. So I'm well known for whiffing the slow ball down the middle, but I think I can handle this one.
This one, you've been working on it for a decade or more than a decade.
I think that, you know, a lot of people noticed that higher education last spring was much more nimble, was much more capable of making sure that their students were continuing to learn. And I think there's a lesson for that. I don't want to imply that they were exquisitely and consistently excellent. That is part of what happens in a system. And it is different than the traditional factory model, our traditional school system, where they just universally couldn't do it, right? In K-12, the only places where we saw people stepping up were where there was more competition. There were some great charter school networks that stepped up and were able to make sure their students continued learning. Private schools also figured it out quickly. And also some districts came forward. And as we're looking at the pattern, it appears to be those districts that face more competition. So we're big fans of choice and competition here. And it has its limits. And I think that's part of even though it's a softball, higher ed was not perfect. And I think we have some things to learn there as well.
So here's a very specific question on the CARES Act and what's been done. What kind of data will the department be collecting on how states and LEAs use funds to through the CARES Act? Will this become something that is publicly available at some point?
Yes. Again, data transparency, that's part of our motto here. The CARES Act requires quarterly reporting. And that turned out to be fairly easy for there are three big buckets of money. One went to elementary and secondary schools. Another went to governors. And then another group went to higher ed. Just 30 seconds on this. A lot of institutional efforts to make sure that we're being transparent about where the money goes in K-12. Lots of systems around that. We have 52 grantees, states. They get the money, they give it to LEAs, all kinds of systems. And then there are systems already in place to do that quarterly. The governors can also use that system. What people may not appreciate is that this is the first time we gave money directly to institutions of higher education, 5,200 of them. And there were several buckets of money. Mm-hmm. And so developing a system to capture quarterly what's going on there is going to take a little longer. Part of what we're doing is requiring those institutions to post on their local sites what happened to the money. A lot of there are so many buckets of money here, but within the higher ed, there was a 90% of the funding going toward everybody on a formula basis. But half that money needed to be used for emergency aid to students, essentially vouchers for students for everything that they were facing in the economic crisis. And following that money is a challenge. When you're talking about 5,200 schools, thousands and thousands of millions of students. So I don't want to say we're going to be there by the end of the year. We will eventually have all the system's in place. In the meantime, you can go up to your Stanford University website and you should be able to find exactly how they said.
So coming back to learning loss, there's another question here of, have you seen states or localities that are doing an especially good job at adjusting to this learning loss and spending federal money creatively to address the learning problems? Yeah, are you developing a website of anecdotes about who seems to be doing it well?
Yeah, we're collecting those stories. I don't know how we're going to disseminate them. You want to make sure you've parsed all the data when you're doing something like that. It ends up being, you don't want to be publicizing something that just appears to be doing well. It, as I said before, there is a lot of work around empowering individual families that we're getting a lot of positive feedback. Sometimes that was as simple as making sure that they had a Chromebook or some internet device, connectivity and things like that. But yes, we're collecting those. If we make them public, I'll certainly make sure you know that.
Are there any that stand out that where you see that that some particular district or state has really shown leadership in this?
Yeah, there are a couple, but really the best examples tend to be the charter schools. The networks that had already developed fairly sophisticated digital learning. You know, there's one out in your area, Summit Public Schools. Right. They were able to make the transition, and I shouldn't have just used California, like there's success academies in New York. There's several of these around the country. And look, this was hard, but they had the capacity and background that allowed them to make those changes pretty rapidly.
Well, Jim, I think this has been a fascinating discussion that we've had, and I really want to thank you for taking the time out of that pile, pushing yes. The pile a little to the side of the things you had to do today so that you could talk with us. This has been really useful.
Well, it was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Just to remind everybody, this is Assistant Secretary Jim Liu from the U.S. Department of Education, who's been talking about where education is going from as seen from the federal government and what the federal government can do. The next Capital Conversation will be on October 28th at 1 p.m. Pacific time, 4 p.m. Eastern time, with U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff General Charles Q. Brown and Hoover Research Fellow Michael Auslin. And they'll be discussing accelerate, change, or lose. So we welcome you back to this ongoing series about capital conversations, about people that are trying to put good ideas into practice. Thank you all for joining us in this conversation.